Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, and here on EWTN, we have this great privilege on the Journey Home program to hear a story, to hear the good work that the Lord has done in our lives. And tonight we're joined by Dr. Tory Backham, former Episcopal priest, and he's now the director of the Benedictine Center for Family Life in Atchison, Kansas. Doctor,
good to meet you.
Thanks for coming on the
good
show tonight.
You.
Thanks for sharing your story. I really appreciate you being here for that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to step way back and let you begin. Where does your particular journey with the Lord begin?
Well, it begins pretty close to where I am now. It's in Kansas. I'm a fifth generation Kansan. Both of my parents are from Kansas. Their parents were from Kansas. Their parents were from Kansas. My dad's side is largely Baptist. My mother came from a long line of Quakers. Her father and that whole line were Quakers, and we can trace the lineage back to some of the early settlers who were abolitionists. So these are the groups of people that moved out from Pennsylvania and the East Coast to stop the spread of slavery. Wow. Kind of over our dead bodies was their attitude. My mom started going to the Episcopal Church before I came onto the scene, but then she stepped out of church. That might have had a little influence on my becoming an Episcopalian when I was in my early 20s. So it started in Kansas. There was some devotion, especially among my grandparents. I told you about my grandfather, who's Quaker farmer. My grandmother was a Baptist. She had 10 children. I tell people she wasn't Catholic. She was old school Baptist.
Yeah.
Very saintly woman, had a huge influence on my life. Loved her deeply. Eight of her children were girls. And one of them became really close to, she was the only one who married outside of Protestantism into the Catholic Church. And I spent a good bit of time with her when I was growing up. She had an important influence in my life. So that was kind of the journey, Heinz 57, Protestantism in the middle of the United States. Certainly not agnostic, but not everybody was practicing.
Yeah. Was there a particular church or group that you attended growing up?
Well, through my elementary years, I was largely unchurched. My parents separated when I was young. Okay. My brother and I moved to Kansas City, and we lived with our mom. And so we were largely unchurched the years we lived in Kansas City. I think there was a Nazarene church bus that came by the apartment complex where we lived, and we went to Sunday school or vacation Bible school. We moved to Texas to live with our father, who was Baptist. So we started attending what was an interdenominational Baptist youth group. The thing I learned about, Texas, though, is that everybody's Baptist, even the Catholics. And so it was just the culture. And so we kind of made our way into the faith. Mm-hmm. I was baptized in the Baptist church. Mm-hmm. Spent the next few years. While I was in college, I was in a Baptist college, but I started exploring Anglicanism, partly through the writings of Lewis and, the usual suspects, yeah. C.S. Lewis and John Stott. And I went to an Episcopal seminary in Pittsburgh, not as a postulant, but just to explore. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I became an Episcopalian.
Okay.
Yeah.
Up to this point, would you say that you were still sort of nominally generally Christian, or had you had a come to Christ moment?
Yeah, well, I'm just tied in with the baptism.
Okay.
I encountered the resurrected Christ.
Right. Okay.
And I was Baptist, Baptists believe in what they call believer's baptism. And so you had to have a profession of faith. You had to have a testimony. Mm-hmm. And I did have those. The Baptist, quasi-Baptist, it was an ecumenical youth group.
Sure.
Was very influential. I don't know if you've seen the new movie out, Jesus Revolution.
I have not yet.
But that was on the, I was on the tail end of that. Gotcha. That came to Texas. So Keith Green was a well-known musician, and Leonard Ravenhill was this holiness preacher, and English holiness preacher, and they set up shop in Lindale, Texas, which is about halfway between Dallas and Tyler in East Texas. And so my girlfriend, who was Catholic, and myself, we would meet there for this youth group Bible study. And young people from all over East Texas would come. Wow. Keith Green would play the piano, and Leonard Ravenhill would give an exhortation. So that was a very intense time. I really received my call into the ministry during that time. My girlfriend, who was Catholic, became a Wycliffe Bible translator,
wow,
which she's done her whole life. And we've remained friends. And so we kind of laugh how she kind of started working with the evangelicals and I become Catholic. So we,
yeah. Know.
But that was a spiritually rich time.
Yeah.
It was authentic. It was real. There were some deficits, you know, sacramental deficit, a deficit of not being connected to the Catholic Church. Mm. But I could never say it wasn't real.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So you had a real call to a sense of call to ministry. Now, why did that not end up? Did you consider becoming a Baptist minister or kind of that?
No. I was never.
How'd you get turned in the sort of the Episcopalian direction?
Well, yeah, I was never a good Baptist. I mean, that was part of the problem, and we don't want to go there. You know, I was exploring options. You know, so no, I thought about. I was good with languages. I thought about being a Wycliffe Bible translator. Actually, I went to Wycliffe. They had these summer institutes of linguistics programs. I studied at a university for a while to study linguistics, thinking I might do that. I never could see myself as a Baptist pastor. I just felt like I would fail miserably, and I'm sure I would have. And but it was during that season of discernment, well, do I become a missionary? And I would go home and work on my grandfather's farm, picking apples. He had an apple orchard, and doing a lot of praying and thinking, and I was also reading all these Episcopalian books, Anglican books, C.S. Lewis.
Oh, right, yeah.
And Stott, Chesterton, his both pre- and post-Catholic books.
Yeah.
And
why did those spark your interest? What were they? Where did they fit in kind of your world?
Well, I think they were feeling to, you know, I think there was a, I don't think Catholicism was a possibility for me at that time, because I didn't know any Catholics really, other than this one aunt who lived in another part of the country, though I was drawn to her. I remember once she said to me, "Tori, the Baptist taught me Jesus, but Catholics made him beautiful to me." I never forgot that. I mean, it was like the best apologetic, but I didn't know Catholics except for this girlfriend. And my dad was deeply anti-Catholic and, you know, viscerally so. And I think Anglicanism was the closest I could get to Anglicanism without totally destroying our relationship. And even becoming Anglican really put a strain on our relationship, but it survived. I mean, that story gets better later on. Sure. So there were those factors, just geography, what was available. I could attend Episcopal churches,
yeah,
without being disowned. And, you know, I just, yeah, I didn't know enough, frankly. I just didn't know enough. And, but I kept, you know, looking and searching. And then I studied church history. And the more I studied church history, I started questioning some of the narrative that I had been taught early on.
Sure.
I remember taking a class. I was for 1 year in a Baptist seminary before I went to the Episcopal seminary, and I took a class with really a wonderful teacher. I still am delighted by him. Tom Nettles is his name, and he taught many years at Southern Seminary, but he taught a class on patristics. And I remember reading this book on patristics, and at the end of the semester, I'll never forget these, he said, because a lot of us are scratching our heads, like, you know, I never heard this in Baptist Sunday school class, you know. And so he asked, well, how many of y'all think these early church fathers were Christian, that, like, knew the gospel? Because, I mean, that was the kind of the conversation in the class.
Right.
And I raised my hand and I looked around and I was the only one in the class. And that was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't willing to say I agreed with them on everything, but I wasn't at all willing to say these guys aren't Christian. I mean, I knew enough to know, you know, it's really hard to be a revisionist when you're being persecuted, you know, when your faith is going to cost you your life. That's not when you go into revisionism.
Yeah.
You know, so that was an interesting moment.
Yeah.
And I've had that moment over the years in different groups of Protestantism about, well, like, yeah, I really do think John Paul II is a Christian. And not only that, I think he's actually probably right about almost everything, you know. So I've had that experience over the years as I've taken the journey.
Sure.
And in fact, you know, that's a lot of what you have to do when you take the journey is repent of a lot of past inadequate solutions.
Mm. Yeah, you got to be open, right? It's like that beginning of the Gospel of Mark, Christ's first words there, repent and believe the gospel.
Yeah.
It's not the other way around. There has to be an initial repentance of just being open to maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's more that God wants to give me. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I mentioned my father's, we got his, he approached death a few years ago. You know, he told me he knew I was a man of God, was sorry that he opposed my spiritual journey as much as he had, which was kind of giving me tacit permission to go on. He didn't know I was thinking about the Catholic Church. I mean, we had lived so far apart that there was no reason to, you know, tell him those things. And I didn't want to give him heartburn. And so, but I felt like that was kind of a permission. And I started my process into the Catholic Church about a year after he died.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So backing it up a little bit, so you entered, when did you approach that Episcopal seminary and enter that ministry?
Great question. That was in the 80s, mid-80s, early to mid-80s. I went, I had a great class by a really godly mentor, John Rogers. He was Karl Barth's last PhD student, and he taught a class on the atonement. They had these January terms, and I loved it. I loved my years at that seminary. It was the great, wonderful bridge for kind of a renegade, messed up Baptist who didn't know what he really was, but just knew he wasn't Baptist. That was a great place for me to enter more fully into the world of the Church Fathers, into kind of a historical consciousness, though I would say that I would want to press them to enter more fully into the history of the church. But really good people. Good people, solid. I still have many friends in that world, that camp.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking tonight with Dr. Tory Backham, former Episcopal priest. So it was a good experience at that seminary, and you ended up becoming a priest.
Yeah. My first job was in Little Rock, Arkansas. This was in the 80s. Bill and Hillary Clinton, where Bill was the governor, and he lived two blocks from me.
Wow.
My boss, who really became one of the most important men and mentors of my life, his name was Joel Pugh. He was the dean of the cathedral. He had been a chaplain at Oxford University, I think the first American to ever do so. Rhodes Scholar, like Bill Clinton, so he and Bill were friends of sorts. So I tell people Little Rock is where I got my real education. I learned a lot from Joel, learned a lot from the people. From there, I went to Kansas City again, which is my boyhood home. And I met Elizabeth, my wife, who was practicing law and waiting for me to show up. And we met and married within 8 months. But I probably would have married her sooner, but I thought, you know, I got to at least wait 8 months. I'm an Episcopal priest. I had some lech from Arkansas coming into Kansas City. I didn't want that story. So, we knew each other, knew right away. Of course, we were in our 30s, so we were older. And we had our first two daughters in Kansas City. And then that's when the Episcopal Church started to, the early stages of its implosion around the doctrine of marriage And that's when I first was encountered with the question, you know, what is the nature of Christian marriage? And I realized I was woefully inadequate. I was not prepared. For that question, I actually, it was in Kansas City that somebody handed me a book by this new young Polish Pope, John Paul II, Crossing the Threshold of Hope. And I crossed an epistemological threshold at that point. I encountered a mind I'd never encountered before. He thought differently. He's not a linear thinker. He's a spherical thinker. And he's a poet. So even when he's writing prose, it's like poetry. I only understood about half of it because I had no background in Thomism or personalism, which are the categories out of which he thinks. So it started me on a journey of reading Aquinas and reading personalist philosophy to try to understand it better, because I was mesmerized. And I continued that for many years, partly out of interest, partly more than interest, but I didn't really have an existential drive to do it until I was in D.C. Then it became no longer theoretical, you know.
Yeah.
So that was a really important chapter and phase.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Up to this point, I mean, you said you encountered this issue with marriage, but beyond marriage, you know, in terms of doctrine in general, like, what was your sense up to this point about the differences in doctrine, even between your upbringing and your Episcopalianism? Was it just, what did you make of those up to that point?
You know, I don't like to use this term. But I think in this instance it fits. You know, conservatives just, like, we receive traditions and we live out of them without thinking so much about them, right? And then they're challenged. And then you go, well, why do I believe that? You know, why do I believe that marriage is between a man and a woman? You know, because you never had any reason to question it, right?
Right.
And so then you have to go back and you have to start reading. And of course, you read the scriptures, but you read the great minds that have interacted with it, with the teaching. And that's what I did. And I, because it was tacit knowledge, you know, that's why I don't think I was ever taught really anything about it, because it was like, well, of course, nobody questions this. Right. Well, that we were, you know, and there I was in the vortex of it. I was in the one Protestant denomination that was, you know, going to war over it.
Right.
And so I started looking around for, well, who makes sense? Who's helping me to answer my own questions? And of course, I had this background of a broken home. And a lot of that went on there that we don't need to get into, but it primed me to have a real sensitivity, because I several generations of broken homes, I understood what it did to children, and all of my siblings were affected by it deeply. I was affected by it. And so it wasn't theoretical, you know, and I was going to have to make decisions about who would I marry, who would I not marry, and can I even be in a place like this, you know, and that's when I realized I had to go deeper. And the person who took me by my hand and led me deeper was Saint John Paul II.
Right.
Even before I knew what was going on.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. So what happened next? And at this point, you're still a priest and you're married. Now you have kids there in...
Yeah, I went to Asbury Seminary to do a PhD in missiology. I was working with a church out of London, Holy Trinity Brompton, who started this thing called the Alpha Course that went worldwide. And I... became a speaker for them. I served on their board. I did a dissertation on Augustine's Catechumenate and Wesley's Class Meeting, because those were the kind of the worlds I was straddling. And so I was interested in the whole nature of Christian hospitality, the history of hospitality. Asbury's really good at that. Had a wonderful doctoral mentor, Howard Snyder, who he himself studied at Notre Dame, did his doctorate at Notre Dame. So, I read more Catholic missiologists than I did Protestant in that program. So that, you know, continued the development. And I also, there was a wonderful Methodist sage. He was a retired president of Asbury College. you know, that's been in the news recently because of the revival. But his name is Dennis Kinlaw. He would tell you in his later life that John Paul II was the most influential theologian in his life, you know. And so once a month we would gather together, he and I, and we read through different works of John Paul II. I still hadn't hit an existential crisis, you know, but I was more and more leaning into this man's thought world. So that was great. And those were special years, and that is a community I still love and am close to. The president of Asbury Seminary is a really fine man by the name of Tim Tennant. He's been a really wonderful friend as I've made this journey into the Catholic Church.
So did you complete your PhD there?
I did. And then I got called to a church outside of D.C., in the D.C. area, that was one of these churches that broke away from the Episcopal Church to form a new Anglican body. And I went to serve that congregation, and I was there for 13 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 13 years. Did you... I mean, in all that time, especially being drawn more and more to JP2, did that, you were still comfortable with all that? It didn't cause an existential crisis yet? What happened next?
Well, I mean, the issue within Anglicanism continued to, you know, be at a low boil. Yeah. And of course, the cultural issues there in D.C., they continued. And then in my own parish, they continued. So I inherited a number of crises, some legal crises, clergy sexual crises. And that just brought me to a place that I had to go deeper. And I went deep into John Paul II. I remember I had some friends in London. I said to them, I said, here's what I'm struggling with in my parish. These are things I've inherited. And the only person who was helping me with them was actually the Episcopal bishop that I was in a lawsuit with. And it's wild. And Washington Post did a story on it, two stories on it, one in 2011, another in 2020. Then the New York Times did a story on it. So when you're pastoring a church and you have papers doing stories on you, it's a whole new world. Yeah. But these friends in London, they said, Tori, you need to go see Don Renzo. I said, Don who? And they said, no, he's an Italian priest, Don Renzo Benetti. And I got on a plane to Rome to go see this man because these friends who I had great respect for said, he can help you through this. Mm-hmm. And now when you're an Anglican priest in D.C. and you get on a plane to go to Rome for help, you know you're in trouble. I was in trouble. And so Don Renzo, I went to a retreat that he did in Sacrofano right outside of Rome, and he has this network of domestic churches, couples that he mentors and teaches. He basically is a master pedagogue, and he's taken John Paul II's philosophical anthropology and he's put it in the reach of the laity. Wow. So I walk into this room and it's literally like 300 families, you know, and I'm like, and it was just so beautiful, John Mark, and I felt like I'd died and gone to heaven, you know. And as I used to say, as an Anglican pastor, I didn't think that could happen in Rome. And it was like Jesus's parable, the pearl of great price. I realized at that point I had to give up everything to possess that.
Yeah.
So over the next 5 years, I brought him to my parish every year to teach. Wow. That, you know, went so-so. Mm-hmm. But I went over there every year. Went to Rome, went to Bovalone where he lived, and he really mentored me. And I think by that time, intellectually, I had converted. But emotionally, psychologically, and I'm also stubborn, you know, I really, by this time, the Archbishop of Canterbury had appointed me to a post called the Six Preachers of Canterbury Cathedral, and he wanted me to be an agent of reconciliation between the dissidents and him. And I did my best to do that, did not succeed. And so I just realized that Anglicanism, and I told this to the Archbishop. I mean, I went to him in person to resign and told him I was converting. Mm-hmm. And And actually, the Episcopal bishop, who I had been in a lawsuit with, came with me, you know, because he had walked. He also walked with me on this.
Yeah.
And I just said, I don't believe in the Anglican project anymore. And I'm not angry. I'm not upset. I believe the Catholic Church is telling the truth. Yeah. All the things that I care about, the things that I've given my life to understand and to live. I said, I think they're telling the truth. That doesn't mean I think every bishop is telling the truth and every person of Catholic. But I'm just saying the church as the church, I think it's holding the truth together. And the truth is more, and maybe more importantly, the truth is holding it. And so he was wonderful, and he said, Tori, if I were in your shoes, I'd probably do the same thing. He's a beautiful man.
Yeah.
And as you know, he's close friends with Pope Francis, that's a whole other thing. But, he was really good to me and very kind, very pastoral, and that was hugely helpful, and as was the Episcopal Bishop of Virginia. Yeah. So.
Well, let's pause there, a little break, and we'll pick it up and see all the fallout from that revelation, that connection there. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Tori Bakum's story. I want to remind you that if you have a story, if you're a convert of the Catholic Church, we'd love to hear it. We'd love to know, where you came from. We'd love to hear what went on and how you ended up as a Catholic. And so check out chnetwork.org. We've got a newsletter there. We've got a contact form. We'd love to, again, hear from you and hear about your own journey to the Catholic Church. We'll be back again in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Dr. Tori Bakum's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with Dr. Tori Bakum, a former Episcopal priest. And we're going to talk about it more in a little bit here, but he's the director of Benedictine Center for Family Life in Atchison, Kansas. When we left off, you had just approached the Archbishop of Canterbury? Along with your Episcopal bishop, to tell them that you felt you could no longer be Anglican.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, they were both great about it. Bishop Shannon Johnston, the Episcopal bishop, when I left Virginia, and though I wasn't under his jurisdiction any longer, we were close friends, and he gave me two commemorative coins, one at the beginning of John Paul II's pontificate and one at the end that had been minted in Krakow.
Wow.
And it was very moving, and it was out of his own personal collection. And so that was an important, turning point.
Yeah.
But I left with their blessing, mm-hmm. and I was grateful for that.
And did you have where was your family in all this? What did your wife think about this?
Well, my wife was taking the journey with me, but her route was not John Paul II or the Polish Catholic Church. It was a Salesian spirituality, Jane de Chantal, St. Francis de Sales.
Yeah.
And of course, he was the Bishop of Geneva on the early stages of the Reformation. So Martin Bucer was the pastor of Geneva just after Calvin died, And so he set up shop in Annecy, France.
Yeah.
We're going to go there this summer. Our oldest daughter's getting married in Germany. So after the wedding, we're going to go to Annecy, France,
wow.
and do a pilgrimage. So that was her route. And she went very deep into Salesian spirituality while we were in D.C. The head of the International Order of Oblates was her spiritual director. And so she was great for me because, he was the great peacemaker, and he was 200 years ahead of his time at least.
Yeah.
And 300 maybe, I don't know. And she would say, "Can I get a load of this?" And she'd give me something to read, and saying, you need to take this on, because we were in a very conflicted, angry moment in the life of Anglicanism, mm-hmm. In that part of the world. So I would like to say that I learned all the lessons that he had to teach. I don't think I did, but he helped me. I would have done worse than without him. So totally in. My daughters are in different places. They're young adults. One of them, I think, will become Catholic. She's on that journey, goes to Mass regularly, obviously doesn't receive communion. But the other two, it's more challenging. The youngest went with me to Poland this last March. At the end of the trip, she came up on the bus, sat with, she was the photographer for the group, and she came up and she said, "Daddy, I now understand why you do what you do. I understand why you took this journey."
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a special moment.
That's beautiful.
You know, you get at a certain age with your children that you can't really explain stuff to them.
Right.
You know, you just, they just have to see it for themselves. Mm-hmm. So when people go with me to Poland, they understand why I do what I do.
So you left that meeting, and what was the process there from, you had to, you mean you resigned there, but did you join RCIA, or what was the process of entering the Catholic Church?
Yeah, well, Father Paul Scalia and Father Dominic Legg, who's one of the Dominicans in D.C., they accompanied us. Father Dominic Legg took us through the catechism, kind of his version of personal catechesis. And it was Father Scalia who introduced me to Archbishop Naumann and Steve Minnis at Benedictine. I remember I came to his office once. I said, "You know, I think we're supposed to convert. I want to convert, but I have no idea how to do it. And I'm really encumbered, and I don't think it's going to be easy." And he said, "Well, I was just in Kansas City, and they were looking for somebody like you."
Yeah.
So that was in 2018, and that was before I had the meeting with the Archbishop. Okay. But I had the March meeting with Archbishop in November of 2019. And so... So we were talking, and then the position in Kansas City opened up in Atchison at Benedictine College. So we came. Then COVID hit, like right in the middle of that kind of transition. So it took us a while to get out there. We didn't get out there until the summer of 2020. But I actually started my job in February of 2020.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's really wonderful. I mean, one thing that we were familiar with and we care a lot about here at the Coming Home Network is my father founded the ministry to accompany pastors who
right.
were thinking about becoming Catholic. And many people who aren't in that world don't recognize what a difficult journey it is in general, but then also the ways that it can become difficult because you don't enter the Catholic Church with any promise that you will be, that you be a priest, that you're even going to be able to continue in ministry. And you'd had the call to ministry. And so you kind of have to lay that down and be open to perhaps not picking it back up. It was a very blessing that you were able to connect with that job. It's wonderful.
Well, I have to give thanks to Father Paul Scalia. I mean, and he, early on in one of our conversations, he said, "Well, do you want to become a priest? Because, you know, there's a process for that,
right.
You know, and it's easier for Anglicans than others. I'm not sure it should be, but it is." And I said, "No, I really don't." I said, "If I'm a priest, I have to be responsible for all the sacraments. I only want to be responsible for one, marriage. That's really my passion. That's what I'm concerned about."
Yeah.
I had developed all these relationships in Europe. I knew the Catholic Church in Europe much better than I did in U.S. Because of Don Renzo, Father Cantalamessa was a friend of mine. When I lived in Kentucky at Asbury, the bishop there, Ron Gaynor, he's now in Harrisburg, but he was in Lexington, and he and I jointly, we'd become friends through John Paul II.
Yeah.
We jointly invited Father Cantalamessa, Raniero Cantalamessa, to do a joint Protestant-Catholic mission, and it was phenomenal.
Mm-hmm.
And so he became a friend through that experience. So I knew Catholics in Europe. I didn't know them in the U.S. that much, except for Bishop Gaynor, who accompanied us really wonderfully from a distance. And so Father Scalia, you know, he opened doors saying, you know, here's some folks that are looking for somebody like you. Because I told him, I said, "I want to work on marriage. I want to do domestic church. And I have a PhD, so I could go into an academic community, actually work, you know, with three or four different academic communities right now." So, So that's kind of how that happened. And it continues to evolve.
Yeah.
The profile continues to expand.
Sure.
Yeah. I need another life. It's like, no, I tell people I've had more fruit the last 3 years than I did the previous 30 years as an Anglican Episcopalian.
We'll talk more about that work. I mean, what a blessing to encounter that job that seems to connect with your passion and the continuing work and what's come out of it. That's true.
Well, you know, Steve Minnis is a world-class college president, and he led this season of discernment called Transforming Culture in America. And actually, he invited Elizabeth and I to serve on the committee of that. And that was kind of a testing period for us to see if we fit, could we make a contribution. And they started five different centers. One of them was on the Center of the Family, mm-hmm. Center for Family Life. And it's like a church plant, you know, okay. I'm responsible for everything. You know, I'm the only guy on the payroll. So if it goes well, you know, they pat me on the back. If it doesn't go well, I can't deflect anyone.
What all does the center do?
Well, we have three pillars.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm so glad you asked. Three pillars. First pillar is restoration. We try. Atchison is one of the poorest communities in the Midwest.
Wow.
25% of the population live under the poverty line and have for a couple of generations. So it's baked in.
Right.
So we want to restore families, get them, get children back onto sequence. You know, that is, get an education, get a job, get married, have children, and in that order.
Yeah.
Because they're out of sequence for multiple generations.
Yeah.
So it's not, I tell all my friends, it's usually not a good thing for somebody to get pregnant at 13.
Yeah.
It's a death sentence socially. Mm. So we've gone into that. We're working in the public schools. Mm. We've introduced a curriculum called the Human Dignity Curriculum. That started by a friend of mine, Anna Halpin, with World Youth Alliance. And this is the first public school in the United States to do this curriculum. And we're having remarkable success. The teacher of the school is Letitia Downey. She's African-American. She's Pentecostal. I went to her Pentecostal church for a year mm-hmm. when I got there. We became friends. Just last month, she was invited to the UN to speak about this experiment and what it's doing. So she's being promoted, but she's wonderful. So she's a senior fellow of the center. And she's also a graduate of Benedictine.
Wow.
So that's pillar one. Mm-hmm. I could say more about it, but that's enough to say. Then we have formation. We want to bring couples, especially Catholic couples who are on the edges of the parish, to bring them closer into the center of the parish and into the full power of the sacrament of marriage. And so we work with an organization, a friend of mine, J.P. DeGance, Communio. I actually met and worked with both Anna and J.P. while I was an Anglican, tried to bring them into my parish. And J.P. DeGance started this ministry, Communio, where they really have cracked the code on how to build a bridge into the community to get people to come on a journey of personal and marital enrichment. So that instead of like marriage ministry being down in the basement of the parish where it is mostly, they're putting it up on the front porch. It's how we're leading and greeting people, because people are in a lot of relational pain.
Yeah.
And when they're in relational pain, they want to go to the place that gives them hope. And so it's a whole catechetical process that we're teaching. There's the catechetical theme coming through again.
Yeah.
So and I'm working with 10 parishes in the Archdiocese that I'm coaching with this new approach to catechesis and working with JP's team. So I think it's one of the most important things going on in North America right now. Mm-hmm. The third pillar is exploration. And that's, we do a deep dive into John Paul II's theology. And I have JP II fellows from the college. I have about a dozen of them a year. And they do two things. They study John Paul II. They are tutors of this human dignity curriculum in the public school. And then either their junior or senior year, I take them to Poland. So I do an intense trip to Poland. And so we can understand that this anthropology of John Paul II just wasn't an idea, but it was a lived response to the totalitarianisms of the 20th century, Nazism and Stalinism. So I take them to the actual places where he was innovating this theology and putting it into practice. So those are the three pillars.
Yeah.
Restoration, formation, and exploration.
Yeah. You know, many people... So first of all, I want to back up to what you said about when you, becoming Catholic, you weren't interested in pursuing the priesthood and the all the sacraments. You wanted to embrace your marriage.
Right, right.
You know, the idea of marriage being a sacrament is new to, maybe new to many non-Catholic Christians. But even Catholics may not mean much to. What does it mean for marriage to be sacramental?
Right.
Yeah.
It's a great question. I mean, I think I wrote something for you. I said it. You know, John Paul II called it the primordial sacrament. And the way I tell people is that, you know, Aristotle had a continuum from metaphysics to politics. And I said the primordial sacrament is closer to metaphysics than it is politics.
Yeah.
Huh. You know, it really goes back to the origin of all things, Genesis 1:2, which he did a lot of his catechesis out of those two chapters right. of Genesis. You know, marriage is about unity. But you can't have unity without difference. And what people need to see is that Jesus brings you together with this other different person to make you whole, to make you one. And this is a window into what the Lord is doing with the whole world. You know, in the Genesis narrative, the last thing created, all these binaries, heaven and earth, all these binaries, the last one is male and female, mm-hmm. which holds them all together. Mm-hmm. You know, in the way, and I think that's Genesis 1 is Hebrew ontology. You know, man and woman in marriage hold heaven and earth together. It is the great metaphysical adventure story that we're all in some form or fashion tied into, either because we are married or we came from one, mm-hmm. right? So the sacrament of marriage teaches that. It gives people a lens through which to look at their life and that, so that Jesus is with them. Don Renzo always used to say, he said, when you're out of sorts with your spouse, he said, don't turn your backs on each other. Always go towards each other. That's where you'll find Jesus.
Mm.
That's
beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have enough time on this program for me to keep going on this one. I can keep going.
Well, make sure you get a chance to talk about your work now in Poland.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bring us up to speed on them.
Well, my lovely parish in D.C., they gave me permission to take these trips, and I'm so grateful to them for that. And I went to Poland a lot, partly out of a search. Partly, I got invited by this well-known Polish poet, Adam Zagiewski. And in fact, he was quoted in the New York Times article about me because Michael Paulson, who did the article, he said, well, when you went to go see Shannon, who you were in a lawsuit with, you said you took him a book of poems. Who was it by? And I said, well, Adam Zagiewski. So I got in the New York Times. Adam read it. He emailed me. He said, you must come to Poland. Well, I come to Poland. And what I realized is he started introducing me to all of these world-class Catholic intellectuals. Well, left of center. They were upset with the church on something, usually. But they were all Catholic. They didn't repudiate the faith. And these are some of the most remarkable people I've ever met. And so they became my friends. And they taught me a lot. And I started to see the Catholic Church whole, not just as, one competing denomination, which I know the Catholic Church isn't. But in America, you tend to, if you're outside of the church, you tend to look at it that way. But I saw it whole, and I saw people who were at odds with the church in some way, but they didn't repudiate the faith. And I'd ask them about John Paul II. Their faces would always brighten up. Mm. I remember one scholar, and I'm not going to name any of these people other than Adam. Adam died 2 years ago. But he told me the story, and he actually took me to the grounds in Krakow where John Paul II had his outdoor mass in his 1979 visit. And he said, Tori... We got out in the field, and he said, people started showing up 48 hours before the event, 24 hours was filling up. He said, Poles don't gather together without getting drunk. You know, I mean, the vodka's flowing, right? And he said, but nobody drank. And he got there, and it was quiet. And he said, that man lifted the whole country. You know, tears are filling his eyes. He was a big old philosopher. And like I said, he wasn't an overly pious guy. And he said, because of John Paul II, I believe in the Holy Spirit.
Wow.
Now, when you have conversations like that, you never forget them.
Yeah.
And so I just kept going back. I kept getting invited. I knew this was a special encounter and God was giving me a special gift, but I didn't really know what it was for. After my conversion to the church and working at Benedictine, I was preparing students to go. I remember when we converted and we moved back to Kansas City, I told Elizabeth, I said, well, one thing that's going to stop is my international trips. I said, you know, we're going back home and it's going to be a much more quieter, you know, I was trying to reassure her, you know, I won't be in the limelight anymore. I was in Poland 5 times last year, wow. You know, so it's like, so I was taking some students to Poland, literally 3 days before we left, Putin invaded Ukraine. Mm. So a friend of mine said, called me up. He said, Tori, I told him, I said, I can't bring the students. You know, parents won't let me and it would not be prudent. And he said, well, I can understand that they shouldn't come, but you should come. He said, put on your peacemaker's hat and come and observe. So I did. And he sent me out to the Warsaw train station one day. He said, just go out there and observe. So I went out for a day and I just interviewed people. And the look of trauma on these faces is they came off the trains by the thousands. Then later that night, I go to Mihail's home for dinner, and they already have a Ukrainian family living with them. And the father stayed behind. He was a Uniite priest, so a priest of that is connected to the Vatican is Catholic, but their liturgy and their discipline is all Eastern. Hmm. So he sent his family. And so I had dinner. You know, we had like, you know, 15 people around the table that night. At the end of the dinner, their boy came up to me and handed me a drawing of a U.S. bomber that he drew during the dinner conversation. And he said to me in English, he said, please help. So that day really felt like the Holy Spirit was recruiting me to do something. And I told him, I said, I will. I didn't know how, but I said, I wrote something for my Facebook post and some other things. My friend Mikhail, he translated them into Polish. They went viral. So I was invited to come back in June to speak at a Congress that the government was putting on about Europe and this issue, which kind of surprised me. But Mikhail says, you understand us better than we do. We want you to come. So I said, well, if I come, I need to bring my rabbi friend, Mark Gopin, who's at George Mason University. And I said, he's the world expert on this. This is really the guy you need. Mm-hmm. And they said, we'll bring him too. So he came and Mark just rocked the house. He was phenomenal. And that's when he said, I've done refugee work all over the world for 30 years, and I've never seen anything like this. 3 million refugees, no refugee camp. So I started going deeper into Polish history, and which was already a hobby of mine, but I started reading more deeply and reflecting. And then so when I got back this winter from another trip, I got an email that I had been elected to the Polish Academy, the Copernican Academy. And so I gave a talk there last March, which has since been redacted and published, and it's been published by Lambeth Canterbury in England. It's gone all over the UK. Now it's getting published here in the US. So we're Rabbi Mark and I hope to help the University of Warsaw build a center on peacemaking and solidarity. Mm-hmm. To help with this refugee crisis, equip the people to do the work that they're already doing, but doing it in a way that they too are not traumatized, because trauma gets transmitted relationally. And so trying to understand the difference between empathy and compassion, how you live out of compassion, which is a positive psychology, mm-hmm. that is very healing. all of it's contained in Jesus's parable of the Good Samaritan.
Yeah.
And so that's a whole new chapter that's opened up, and I'm trying to figure out how to do three jobs, you know. That's what I said. I need a longer life. But Archbishop Nauman has been wonderful in supporting me. He's a great lover of your show, by the way. And President Menas has been very supportive. As I said, we just took students there last month. We'll be taking students there again next year. I want to give our students an opportunity to study there. So we're contemplating some programs that we're developing between Benedictine and Poland to give our students an opportunity to study and learn from these really remarkable people that I love.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Thanks for that awesome work and for sharing it with us. We've just got about 4 minutes left.
Okay. And
so with all that in mind, you know, backing up just a little bit, thinking of someone watching who comes from a similar background to you, again, maybe, you know, whether Episcopalian, Anglican, in those communities, you know, loves Jesus, mm-hmm. you know, but sees some of the turmoil in the churches, some of the foundation shaking in terms of what's true, what does marriage really mean? What's a word of encouragement you might share with them to continue the journey?
You can't do it alone. You need accompaniment. We were blessed to have a lot of friends in D.C. to accompany us. A lot of it came out of the ecumenical work I'd been doing. I'd already been working with Catholics on the things that mattered to them. And they mattered to me, too, but it really mattered to them. And so when it came my time, they walked with me and my wife, and they had our back. Not everybody was blessed by our decision or announcement, but they were great to walk us through all that and continue to do so. So I would say you need a community, and if you're pastoring a church, or you know you're contemplating this by just your own personal reading and prayer, I'd say, you know, find other couples. If I'd known about your ministry, I would have tapped into it probably. But like I said, I had a good network of people in D.C. that walked with me. That's the single most important thing, I think. Be prepared for deeper purification and transformation.
Yeah.
Because that's going to happen.
Right. That's a good word, yeah.
And not everybody's going to like it and will say things that will be hurtful. You just have to go on.
Yeah.
The Lord has something for you beautiful on the other side of this.
Amen. Amen. Yeah. Well, thank you for that good word. And yeah. I also encourage, like you, I'm a big fan of, big devotee of John Paul II and his writings, his theology. His work on marriage, the theology of the body, all that. Yeah. If someone's sort of intrigued by some of the things you've shared there, what's a good way for them to kind of get into that world? What's the entry point for them?
Well, it really depends on, you know, how you're wired.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a strong philosophical bent, then you could, you know, dive into his catechesis. But if you don't have a background in Thomism and personalism, I wouldn't start there. I think if you know, you like good literature, Clooney Press has published his poems. That's a nice edition. I would really spend time on his Samaritan Woman sequence, which I think is a wonderful insight. And then his one on The Nation, which I can't quite remember the title of it. And then his play, The Jeweler's Shop.
Yeah.
You'll get a wonderful insight into his understanding of marriage. So those are places I would start for maybe the general population, just simply because they're in reach and you don't need a lot of background. But the more you get into his philosophical works, the more you're going to need background.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks so much for sharing story, Tori.
Hey, so good to meet you.
Appreciate it. Thank you for your work.
Yeah.
And we'll be praying for you as the work continues.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. You can check out benedictine.edu to check out this great school, you know, that
it's phenomenal
to connect with out there and learn more about the Benedictine Center for Family Life. And again, I pray that Dr. Torrey's story has been an inspiration to you. There's lots of other stories like his if you check out chnetwork.org. And there's a newsletter you can subscribe there for, you know, a new story every month, you know, from various people who are coming to discover the Catholic Church. And so, and if you're on the journey, you know, we'd love to hear from you, be praying for and with you. So send us a note there. But once again, this is the Journey Home program. We'll be back again next week with more stories. In the meantime, God bless you. We'll see you then.